You are about to enter the pop, pulp, and subcultural minds of several individuals. What may leak into the ether can sometimes be too strange, too confusing for the average human mind. When nerds assemble.
Hello, and welcome to episode 27 of the Nerds Assemble podcast. I'm Emily.
I'm Paul.
I'm Paul, aka Cookie.
And we've got no Retroid this week, sir.
Boo.
He's apparently he's off doing a sterling service matching the political machinations of the evil Tories.
Shelf stacking then.
Yeah, so and yeah. And we are joined this week by Honorary Paul, Peter Cooper.
Good evening.
Oh No Video Games Honorary Paul, Martin Felder.
Hello.
And we are pleased to say that Paul and I are joined today in our living room by James Henry.
Hello. On the sofa.
On the sofa. He is a lovely scriptwriter and quite a geek extraordinaire. Oh, yes. For those of you who might not know, James has worked on such fantastic shows as Green Wing, Smack the Pony, Campus, and my favourite, Shaun the Sheep.
Shaun the Sheep. One episode.
One episode, but you know.
I'm there.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll see. I'm amazed by that because I saw the list of some of your credits before I come on the show, but I didn't see Shaun the Sheep in there. So now I'm
back.
Yeah.
I did see
Bob the Builder though, and I wet the bed.
I got asked though, is this Bob the Builder sort of pre the Americans getting their hands on it?
It's around, yeah, series before. I started series two and then the Americans started working at Evil Magic. We can talk about that.
Okay, we've got obviously lots of stuff to discuss this week. There's been a couple of few news stories, amazingly. And of course, we've got plenty of time for questions with James. First up, I think, in terms of games news in the past week, or even news, just the fallout, Aliens Colonial Marines, what the hell?
I don't know how they keep getting it wrong. It's a very simple formula. It's not hard to do wrong.
It's because it's a movie tie-in.
It's
fine.
Just take Doom 3 and put Xenomorphs in, and it's great. That's all you need to do.
Are they overthinking it? Is this the issue?
No, I think it's not trying hard enough. And the fact is that it's a really simple concept for any decent Aliens game. I mean, look at AVP and AVP2 from the late noughties, or early noughties rather. You know, those were great games.
When they get it right, they get it right.
They've done it twice out of about 15, 20 games that have been made based on the film.
High conversion.
I'd say that since so many games like lift so heavily from Aliens anyway, like that property has basically been done, just not as like a licensed property. So that's the problem with it. Whenever you play like an actual Aliens game, you're measuring it up against all the games which are Aliens, but just like without actual aliens in them. So.
Well, I'm not sure about that. I'm happy with Halo. Yeah, stick with that. I'm perfectly fine with it. But at the same time, though, yeah, I stack it up against the original AVP, which has easily the best campaign. You know, it got panned at the time, but it's easily the best campaign of any Aliens-inspired game, and not a single game that's been based on the property since then or before then has ever matched up to that. And even then, it's not that hard. It's just atmospheric. Very simple level design. You can play it now and it makes you crap yourself. and that's with shoddy, you know, just post original Half-Life graphics.
Yeah, that is what I look for in games. So
if there's one thing I want to get scared by, it's a vaguely rectangular looking face hugger. that makes me just quiver with fear.
Somehow the corners make it scarier.
I think what's worried Paul and myself the most with the panning it's gone in reviews, and also just anyone just talking about it who's played it, is that we were kind of looking forward to the Wii U version. Well, apparently Sega went on the record and denied that Aliens Colonial Marines has been cancelled for the Wii U. They've denied there's any form of cancellation going on. I'm wondering how far, because what sort of release were they looking for?
I'm not 100% sure. I know it was meant to be kind of on the launch lineup, i.e. kind of in the launch window, which is kind of usually for about, you know, kind of 6 to 9 months after the...
So sometime this year.
It's end of March, I think, isn't it?
Maybe they'll put it back because they've realised that maybe they need to do at least a few tiny tweaks, or that it's going to get a huge patch upon launch.
Or they'll just rewrite the whole thing and release a whole new version for the Wii U that actually works.
I'm not sure if I can hope that much at this point.
I think any excitement you had about the game on Wii U should be completely overruled by the fact that you should never have been excited about any version of the game in retrospect. it has turned out so horrendously awful. And I'm a massive Aliens apologist. I adore Aliens. And I thought, man, you know, everyone's saying it's crap. I'm going to, but you know what? I'm going to find some joy in it. Nope.
Look into be the one that writes that one article, which is like, no one else gets it. Let me explain this to you. Got into it? Nah.
I'm the guy that liked the Doom movie. I'm that guy.
Hey, that movie is likable.
it is likable. I'm glad to hear that, and I'm glad that you're willing to say that publicly.
Hey, you know, I've actually got that as a tattoo. The Doom movie is likable across my chest.
I think
we're getting married.
I have made some bad decisions.
I think other than the fact that it's kind of put the Wii U's versions sort of launch in on slightly precarious grounds, or sort of crumbling, earthquake shaken grounds, Destructoid's Jim Sterling, it seems that he's now refusing to do previews as a result of Colonial Marines. That's quite profound, in a way, or just amazing. It's come that far.
I still can't understand how they got it so wrong, because, I mean, it's been in development for God knows how long. It was supposed to have been released, 2 years ago? Or a year ago, at least?
Well, it was originally slated for 2 years from the initial point that it was initially announced, which was 6 years ago. So it should have been released in 2009?
Yeah. So they've had plenty of time to actually rework it, haven't they?
If you've read that Reddit article that was put up by somebody sort of purportedly whistleblowing on the whole operation, you know, they're saying, you know, they kept subcontracting it, they kept putting stuff out. The second that they'd get another big job in, so Duke Nukem Forever or any given Borderlands game, they'd transfer everyone onto that. They'd leave whoever they'd subcontracted out to, who was it they subcontracted to? Was it Timegate?
Wasn't it different companies for different parts?
There were
two or three subcontractors. Yeah. They'd let them sort of go on their merry way, and they'd come back to go, hey, you know what, guys, I've got a great idea. James, I dare say you're very familiar with that.
What's this?
The subcontracting
thing where, you know, people go away for a while and come out and go, hey, you know what? I've got a great idea about something.
Let's
and
throw some paprika into toffee pudding. Yeah. it's just some of those things just left alone for 3 years. That's not that bad. If people coming backwards and forwards and walking in and poking things with a stick. And just Doom lies that way, and not the cool Doom movie, which I also enjoyed. I've seen worse movies.
Yes.
I've seen hundreds of worse movies than Doom.
Oh yeah, definitely.
I think with the subcontracting issue, I mean, in the past sort of 6 months, games that have disappointed Paul and myself, which were heavily subcontracted, Resident Evil 6, while perhaps not as bad as Alien Colonial Marines, it did suffer potentially more than Resident Evil 5 in some aspects, and obviously nothing's lived up to Resident Evil... Did I say 5 or 4 then? Resident Evil 5 it had some issues, but I found 6 worse, and Resident Evil 4 is something that neither have managed to live up to. But 6 had, if I remember, that I read an interview with one of the guys at Capcom that Game Sutra had sort of put up last year, and it was something like over 600 out of house personnel have been working on the game. That's a heavy amount of subcontracting, and to be honest, you can kind of feel it when you actually play 6.
So as a relative gaming noob, Yeah. I'm a light gamer. I have to be honest. I'm not a hardcore gamer. is Subcontract, is that what they... I'll just go now. I'm so sorry. Does that mean different people doing different bits of the game? Like one person doing the bosses, well, and one company doing the bosses?
For instance, the big
trend for the most part when it comes to subcontracting within games is map and level design.
Yeah.
So what you'll see is you'll see a core team within your own company build the core game, and then they'll go, okay, we don't have time or resource to build the 12 maps we're going to release as downloadable content that we're going to sell for the next 12 months or whatever. Yeah. So we'll bring in an outside company to build the levels while we're working on the core game. And then that way we get the whole game wrapped up at the same time. We can just drip feed that at a later stage. We don't have to worry about it anymore, basically.
Okay. Was it Deus Ex? They got one company doing the bosses.
Revolution. That's perhaps one of the more infamous cases of subcontracting of the last few years.
Yeah, because it was like, hey, welcome to a completely different game.
Yeah, so that's the vibe I
was trying to play without any guys. I've been avoiding almost all coverage of Human Revolution when I played it for the first time. And I was going for a stealthy playthrough, which meant I had no weapons of death on me whatsoever. And
he doesn't need them. They're in the rooms. They're in the rooms with you.
But then you spent those awkward first few minutes desperately running around like a headless chicken, trying to find weapons and ammo.
This is why you made the wrong decision by trying that first.
It's like if you're watching a teen comedy and halfway through, there's like one scene of Rambo, and then it goes back to teen comedy and is completely unexplained.
The tonal shift is abrupt in this section. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There should have been warnings. I'm just hoping that maybe the Wii U version can at least, when it finally is released, perhaps be okay. I'm hoping for okay at this point, you know. And apparently, somebody said somewhere that somebody has at least given this current version on the PS3, 360 PC, a 6 out of 10.
Wow, he was smoking some serious dope.
Man, he took all the drugs.
He was in Amsterdam with some brownies and he didn't quite know what was in them.
Oh, dear. Okay, I'm going to take us away from this because it's depressing me slightly because I was holding out of the Wii U version's release.
maybe the Wii U subcontractual team transition department part 3 will be completely on top of it. I'm sure they're the ones who are going to fix it.
Maybe they're just going to release Doom Colonial Marines and everything will be fine. It'll just be Doom 3 HD on Wii U. It'd be brilliant.
They've just like gotten, opened all the graphics in Paint and scribbled aliens over it and that's it, done. Released it. I'd play that. That'd be great. That'd be awesome.
Okay. Any game that requires 1 million hours in MS Paint.
Yeah.
All over that.
All right. Okay, moving on. Was it before Christmas or just after Christmas? Cookie was quite disappointed that Merlin was entering its final series.
That's because they were bastards.
the BBC series about Merlin, in case you don't know somehow and yet listen to this podcast. Obviously we've been wondering, well, the BBC probably were going to replace it with something else. It surely wasn't going to be more episodes of Doctor Who, because that would
make sense, wouldn't it?
I like that.
Yeah, there's suddenly go beyond 13 episodes and some specials, you know, that'd be insane. So what is Merlin's replacement? Well, apparently it's a new TV series based on the mythos of Atlantis, probably called Atlantis, and it's written or been created by the Misfits creator Howard Overman, which leaves me kind of hopeful, because I really like Misfits. But at the same
I like to imagine that it's going to be like a regular kind of costume drama, and then halfway through everyone drowns, and that's the rest of the season. Everyone's dead. The end.
New people bump the surface.
So 1 minute, we've got costume drama in ancient Greece.
Yeah.
Next minute, Poseidon adventure.
Yeah.
We are trapped.
That's a great idea.
I can just imagine now a bunch of people trapped in a temple that's slowly sinking to the bottom of the sea. And there's somehow fires and combustion and this plucky group of like evening wearing diners that are trying to get out.
Isn't this basically the natural state of the Maldives?
I'm not entirely sure. I wouldn't like to speculate on that.
What's the Doug McClure movie? Is it Treasures of Poseidon? There's a Doug McClure movie. I was really hoping it was a 13-part adaptation of a very ropey 60s cheap science fiction movie.
I'm actually a fan of, was it the Atlantis kids animation film that was done way back.
That was great.
Ago.
Yeah, the diesel punky sort of one.
Yeah,
Mike Mignola did a lot of the Hellboy comic illustrator. He did a lot of the design work, which you can sort of see with the weird shit that's in it.
Yeah, I also like, just because, you know, Michael J. Fox's voice work.
Michael J. Fox is always good. Yeah, he's always good. Yeah, I thought it was a really interesting, interesting movie.
I can't imagine this offering from Overman and the BBC being anywhere near as good.
Oh, that's harsh.
I'm sorry.
I can imagine how the Howard Overman bit makes me think, oh, that could be really, really interesting. There isn't really enough to go on in what they've
Yeah, but it's the fact it's following on from what they've tried to do with Robin Hood and Merlin.
I hated Robin Hood so badly.
That was just...
I hated it. I grew up on the Robin of Sherwood.
Well, yes.
The real
Hood. With the theme tune by Clannad. That was awesome.
It was awesome. There was dry ice. It was clearly there was great hair in that. It was a bit muddy. It looked like people who hadn't scuffled about in the field a bit. You know, it was brilliant. Ray Winston. It was superb. And then I wasn't very taken with the.
You see, by contrast, I was raised on Maid Marian.
Yeah,
glad you said that. I was just about to.
But at the same time, though, I kind of like to mentally interlace that with Cadfile.
Oh, yes. Very good.
So, on the one hand, people are laughing at people falling over in the mud and there's Baldrick. On the other hand, Derek Jacobi.
Terrible, ghastly murders. Cadfile, the forensic monk. He was brilliant.
I mean,
they're all blurred together in my head now. I think they could all be just the universe, I like to think.
Maybe someone should just make that show. Have another go at Robin Hood.
Just re-edit so it's all, you know, just clever re-editing could probably do it. The BBC do seem to be quite committed to their sort of Saturday tea time fantasy-ish slot, which I thoroughly approve of in theory. It's just if the only sort of science fiction fantasy you get on telly is this sort of family-friendly stuff, it gets a bit wearisome.
I find it interesting how the BBC have moved on from what they used to do back in the day, which was have this sort of thing on a Sunday afternoon.
Yeah.
Rather than a Saturday evening.
Yeah.
They used to have Box of Delights.
That's the classic. Yeah, absolutely the classic Sunday tea time.
Box of Delights.
I
think with the air of melancholy, that's the Sunday. Maybe Sunday, they just think Sunday's too sad. You know?
I think they started dedicating the Sunday to old people.
Yeah.
You had your Antiques Roadshow, your...
Songs of Praise.
So, yeah, Songs of Praise. You had Last of Summer Wine.
Don't want to say country fast for old people, but...
It's not for young people.
Yeah.
No, I was going to leave it at Last of Summer Wine, you know. I was going to leave it there.
It's basically like
you
2 hours.
You took it that step further. You crossed the line.
It's basically 2 hours of fall asleep to this. So.
Yeah.
Nature's for old people.
I as a young person, I've never been outside. So.
It's awful.
I never will.
No.
What is this strange light? I don't understand.
The yellow face, it burns. Yeah.
Oh. I pull the curtains closed and I look at my Game Boy and my tweeter and...
suddenly all is well.
Okay, going back to Atlantis, it starts filming soon, in fact in April, and they're going to be shooting in Wales and Morocco, which will make a change of it being, I think, Wales and was it Hungary for Merlin? Yeah, so there will be a distinct difference in scenery. I'm not sure if Morocco ever actually came into being sort of owned by the Greeks at any point, even under Alexander.
It didn't.
Okay, so
I think there's some sand there, isn't there? So
there's the sand.
Sand and sunshine.
At the same time, do you know what? If we think about it, the Greek economy could probably do with them actually shooting it in Greece.
You probably could buy a large chunk of Greece to film in, I would have thought, these days.
Yeah.
The only problem with trying to shoot anything in Greece is cars. There are too many of them, and they're always going,
It's either that...
They're really loud cars, dang.
They're very loud cars. You don't go to Athens. It's horrible.
It's either that
just a bunch of cars yelling at you.
It's either that or somebody accidentally takes a photo of a military base and ends up locked up for months on end. That's never happened before, right? Yeah.
I'd like to think those nice people at BBC wouldn't be trying to shoot some sort of Greek version of Top Gun accidentally, you know, from the edge of some military base.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I feel really bad for the guys up in Manchester. You know, they're sat in their nice meter and thinking, finally, we no longer have to subsidise BBC Wales. We can turn it off. No, we're going to film Merlin Series 6 in Wales and Morocco. We're actually going to do it with Atlantis. That's right. They thought they'd gotten away with it, but no.
The BBC continuing their Wales and series Saturday night programming.
I'm assuming, especially in the instance of Atlantis, that anything that's shot in Wales, if they shoot anything in Wales, it's going to be set-based. I can't imagine much of the countryside of Wales being particularly Greek.
Passing for no.
No.
A lot of shots from a very low angle looking up, so you can't really see any of the countryside.
And during that 1 week of Welsh summer.
Yeah.
and there's probably too much green for it to qualify as Greece.
Well, if you want flooding, Wales probably is,
Well, yeah, I suppose. Yeah.
Just wait till Cardiff Stadium floods of its own accord. Push in the old polystyrene pillars, you go. It's on. You're fine.
Okay, I'm gonna move us on to our next story. I'm not necessarily a Superman reader, but I do occasionally delve into it, especially things like good old stuff like The Death of Superman, revisiting that, or Red Son. But there's meant to be a sort of new anthology coming out soon about the adventures of Superman, and DC approached Orson Scott Card as the writer for sort of some of the first comics for this. And this would be fun. You hear the name Orson Scott Card, some of you be thinking Ender's Game. Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, he's fine. But actually, there's perhaps reasons some may not be aware that you might not want to like Card, especially if you're quite sort of keen on the LGBT rights, because unfortunately Card's a bit outspoken when it comes to his views on homosexuality, which he thinks is very, very wrong. And so there's been some petitions and sort of calling DC out on this. It's gone quite vocal over the past week. I believe the last figure I saw was one of the main petitions against it had got 13,000 signatures.
Blimey.
Yeah, to sort of tell DC, no, takes a Card off of this. And DC's response to the whole thing so far hasn't been particularly stellar.
They were hoping for 100,000 signatures and loads more publicity than they actually got.
So, yeah, it's sort of a popular choice. Has anyone got any thoughts, feelings towards this matter?
I don't know. It's not an opinion about Superman in particularly, or his treatment of the Superman franchise or whatever. It's mostly just I loathe Orson Scott Card because that dude is kind of a fascist based on all of the stuff he writes and all the stuff he says at all times. And I wish no one would ever give him money for anything ever. That's just my view on the whole thing.
I'm gonna throw a cat amongst the pigeons and defend Orson Scott Card and his selection for this.
You go, girl.
I mean, it's funny you should mention Red Son because Mark Miller is a somewhat distasteful writer, and at times, I think that he gets away with a lot of the stuff that he says on the strength of what he did with Red Son and other comic books like that. I mean, Mark Miller, as an example, he has basically trivialized the act of rape. He has said all kinds of inflammatory stuff, and he's just very unpleasant at times. I still love his work. I still love his books. I don't like him, but that wouldn't stop me reading one of his books. Now, I'm not defending Orson Scott Card or his opinions because, they are gross and they are horrible, and I wouldn't defend that kind of opinion at all. At the same time, though, I've read Ender's Game. I've read the entire Ender series, which I've actually been working my way through that. I've just finished Children of the Mind, and great books. Although you can see his interest in marriage and his focus on that through those books. I mean, Speaker for the Dead is all about marriage issues set to, you know, this planet and this sci-fi imagery. It's all about marriage. So I can see running through the work that there is this bias there and that this particular professional interest in the subject. At the same time, I really enjoyed the books, you know, knowing that Orson Scott Card is somewhat unsavory. Doesn't, you know, I can disassociate from that. I can see that there is some great work being done there, the same way that even when I'm reading some of the most disgusting stuff that Mark Miller has written, you know, American Jesus springs to mind.
Hmm.
I can still read that and go, there's still good here. There's still, you know, good work being done. It's a bit unsavory. Don't really like this to that, but otherwise I'm quite enjoying it. I can read Red Sun without going, man, Mark Miller hates women. Yeah, I can disassociate from that. Now, the issue of gay marriage and stuff like that, I mean, that's a hot topic right now. That's a really hot topic. And I don't know if it's people latching onto a hot topic and wanting to, well, not wanting to make a big noise, because it's a worthy cause to support. But because it's such a hot topic right now, it therefore emphasizes the fact that, you know, perhaps this isn't the right time to have Orson Scott Card writing Superman.
Yeah.
But I, you know, with him being hired, if I was a Superman reader, I would not be going out of my way to not read it, just because he's been hired. And also, Mark Miller actually made this point, saying that Orson Scott Card should not get work on the strength of his opinions is just as fascist and just as unpleasant as him saying anything about anyone else.
I think,
you know, denying him the right to be able to do anything after, you know, they've looked at his credentials. They've looked at, you know, he's an award-winning writer. He's a fantastic writer. To say that he has opinions which apparently he can't disassociate from his work, and just flat out refusing him work.
Yeah, but I think. The distinction that's being made by those who are quite unkeen about this is the fact that he's an active member of groups like the National Organization for Marriage. It's not just he holds the opinion, he actually does take place in activities that essentially damage the place and of LGBT groups in the US.
I wonder if it's jarring so much because Superman is such a progressive character, and he always has been, and he is this sort of paragon of virtue. Because I mean, presumably he held these, because when he wrote Ultimate Iron Man, didn't he?
Yeah.
A big chunk of that, I just thought it was really dull, unfortunately. Which doesn't mean he can't write a fantastic Superman. I mean, it's not like Superman's crammed full of gay marriages that he's suddenly going to turn around and, you know, be unpleasant about, or, you know, say maybe retro.
Gay people want to get married? Laser eyes.
Yeah, I just find it unlikely Superman's going to do that. And it's just that it's not a choice, though, because he is a progressive character. I do wonder why that's an issue now where it wasn't with him.
I mean, the momentum against Card over the past year certainly picked up. So it does make me question DC's kind of choice of picking him. I mean, Frank Miller's become quite vocal. Frank Miller, not Mark Miller, but Frank Miller's become quite vocal about certain right-wing aspects that he's interested in the past sort of, well, since 9/11. And he's increasingly finding it difficult to find work with mainstream publishers.
I was actually going to mention John Byrne as well.
Okay.
There's a sort of American tradition, isn't there, of American science fiction writers and comic book writers becoming increasingly sort of right-wing and jingoistic and slightly odd in a way that British comic book writers just never seem to go there. They do like Mark Miller. They have a bit of a twinkle when they do it. So he's sort of winking at half the audience, I think, while sort of, well, God knows what he's doing with the other hand. It's not, you know, the hands.
Being grumpy and Scottish half the time, I think.
Yeah, and it's, you know, God
bless him. I suppose if we're going back to one thing, go back through history of somebody who was quite white right wing, and except for one comic, it didn't really make its way in that often, or maybe two comics. Steve Ditko, when Paul and I were doing research for Cornell Graphic Novel Group for this Ditko meeting we had last year, and sort of finding out the more right wing elements that he tried to sneak into Spider-Man a few times, which Stan Lee basically wrote out, and then the fact that he kind of got his way with his right-wing beliefs when he wrote things like Mr. A and The Hawk and the Dove, and basically those kind of like he expressed his sort of right-wing beliefs basically against things like the Vietnam protest movement.
So they want to read comics only read by sort of, you know, pansy liberal people that I agree with. I do wonder if that's where sometimes you get the really interesting stuff is when people with quite objectionable views meet a decent editor and somehow you get something sort of interesting in the mix. So
I'd make 2 points going back a little bit in this. One of them is about, you know, the idea of separating the art from the artist, which is always going to be something you can go back and forth on. I mean, one in particular, which always comes to mind as like the paragon of that is Roman Polanski, which is very different genre. But, you know, we all know what he did. And yet Rosemary's Baby is an amazing film and arguably a pretty good feminist film in a lot of ways. And yet it's very difficult to separate that from the fact of him. So you can always go back and forth on that. But I think the idea that restricting him and saying, no, you can't write this on account of you have these horrific objectionable views, I don't think that's restrictive or censorship at all. I mean, how many people out there would chop off both of their arms in order to write this, you know? There are so many people that they could have considered, and they went with this guy who has all these horrible views. And even if they don't crop up in the thing, if you make something amazing, then I'm sure it'll be great and that would make me really happy. But it doesn't seem like a choice that needs to be made. Yeah. Just get someone else to do it.
Well,
the alternative to that, I would say, is, you know, the issue with regards to having these objectionable views and so on, that shouldn't stop Orson Scott Card getting the opportunity, but it should basically highlight DC, this is a bad idea.
Yeah.
You know, because that's all PR. That's all a PR issue. You know, there's nothing to do with the quality of the work he's going to put out. And it's nothing necessarily to do with the content of the work it's going to put out. It's purely a case of the PR is going to look bad if you hire a homophobe to write Superman.
And now and it might come out in his work. I mean, unlikely, but there's, you know, there's a chance
that's what editors are for, though, isn't it?
Yeah, I suppose.
That's why you've got some of the best editors at DC, no doubt, involved in this book.
Absolutely.
And
that's the line they're going to have to tread very carefully in it.
Speaking of other people they could have had work on this, though, David Gerrold said on Facebook, he wrote an open letter, and David Gerrold's written for things like The Twilight Zone and Star Trek. In fact, he's the guy that wrote The Trouble with Tribbles.
Cool. I don't know if this is a good thing.
he offered to write a future Superman issues based in the same anthology series in order to offer some balance, because he's actually openly gay. So he's written this sort of open letter to DC saying, well, you could still have Card on, but in order to balance things out, maybe you should kind of hire someone on who's the exact opposite for a couple of future issues. So whether or not DC haven't said anything in response, he sort of put this forward, I think, about Friday. So
maybe if you alternate Orson Scott Card episodes with the gayest writer there has ever been, it could all balance out sort of fantastically.
Yeah,
I'm not sure how that works out. I mean, it
would work out badly. Let's be honest.
Do you know if there are any African American creators on board?
Yeah, that's a good point, to be honest. Yeah. I mean, I don't know if you're kidding or whatever, but I mean, it's more white dudes on it. Like, I'm sure there are
people. She needs more white dudes.
I know this is a podcast full of white dudes, but I mean, I'm sure there are some other viewpoints that would be really great if they wrote a Superman comics anthology.
Mm-hmm. Do you know, I would like to know what would happen, and we've talked about it several times. What would happen if Gail Simone wrote a Superman comic? I'd like to see what would happen there.
I think that'd be good. I'd also be interested to see what would happen if you gave Priest Superman.
Gave a Priest Superman.
If you gave Christopher Priest.
Oh, okay, Christopher Priest.
Right, yeah,
if you give a Priest Superman. No.
What's his face? It might confuse him.
I'm sure that he would just wouldn't know what to do with what someone who is, for all intents and purposes, Jesus. Space Jesus.
Where you draw the line. I mean, it's a guy who's a massive homophobe. You think, oh, okay, I can sort of put that on one side, let him write a comment. Guy who is, you know, massively racist, you probably think, I don't think we should be letting him, you know, have this sort of mainstream pulpit, if you like.
So, I mean,
being a wet liberal, he just, well, I can sort of see both sides. It's quite difficult. Unless it's racism, which is no bad. But, you know, oh, I loathe myself.
Yeah. Okay, I'm gonna move us on from this. Final bit of news, which broke just before we started recording. You may remember that we said a few episodes back that, oh, it looks like Clerks 3 could be happening. Well, it may now not be happening. Kevin Smith tweeted earlier that Jeff Addison, the guy that played Randall in the previous films, isn't sure he wants to be in it again, basically.
And also, J.J. Abrams is not available to direct.
Hey! He is. He's up for
He's too busy going to Wales and filming Atlantis instead.
So has Jeff Anderson basically said, you know what, I'm sick of being disgruntled and sad in your movies, Kevin Smith?
He may have said that. I mean, Smith didn't go out of his way to say anything quite like that. I've taken a picture of his tweet for prosperity's sake in case this one disappears into the ether eventually. But yeah, it was like, oh, Jefferson, he said, yeah, Anderson isn't sure he wants to be it, and the reason probably is he's not sure if he wants to be taking up such a role again. At the same time,
can't they just start with Randall's funeral?
That would be a good start point, but apparently Smith's already got like the script pretty much figured out and written down. So
he's a writer; he can do another one.
What's he doing all day? I mean,
No,
Kevin Smith, you lazy man.
No. You know what Kevin Smith does is like he makes podcasts all day.
Yeah.
To be honest,
you make podcasts than Emily does.
Yeah, I make a lot of podcasts, so.
Come on, Kevin Smith. You've got your millions of dollars. You've got all the time in the world so long as you don't keep eating donuts. You're fine. You can do it.
But Smith said previously that he doesn't really want to make the film if not everyone who is sort of key original characters aren't on board.
Well, yeah, I mean,
it's all right.
About, you know, down to that Randall. So it's
yeah.
Changing the core dynamic like that.
It'll be okay, though, because in Clerks 4, Randall can step out the shower. Situation resolved. It's fine.
See, I just like the idea of tweeting that he's not sure he wants to be on board, because it sounds like Kevin Smith like turning to the audience and going, he's not sure he wants to be involved. What do you think, everybody? You know, like Panto style.
To the great petition mobile. Oh.
Mind you.
Whitehouse.gov.
No, I just think what's going to happen is Jeff Anderson's going to like wake up tomorrow, open his front door, and by his and on his front doorstep will be about like 200 muffin baskets.
No.
All with cards.
There'll be a flying car.
Oh, yes, that's it. Flying car. There will be a flying car on his doorstep.
And then it'll be like, finally, Dante took one for the team.
Yeah.
Kevin Smith is just going to throw the script out the window and say, screw it, I'm done. Next thing you know, Clerks 3 as written by Orson Scott Card.
No.
It's great, but every time they make a smutty joke, then he just comes in and shakes his head at them. Just glares. This is improper.
I kind of want a Clerks 3 to happen. The events of 2 somehow weren't enough for me. Then again, I'm not sure if there could ever be enough Clerks films for me. I would probably watch Clerks like 15, where they're both in a retirement home, and
so that's a very real possibility. Well, not if the guy's dropped.
And Clerks where they got Rocky 5000.
Okay. Yeah.
I can live without any further Clerks films, but you know, if they're going to give it a go, sure. If not, my heart's not breaking.
I mean, to us, there are perhaps a couple of other Smith films that I wouldn't mind sequels to, other than Clerks. Mallrats, you know.
Yep.
No.
It's staring at you from over there.
Oh Jesus! Look at it! first 15 minutes of Chasing Amy was brilliant. I really enjoyed the first 15 minutes of Chasing Amy, and then the rest of the film happened. And I just thought, oh. But I do really like his YouTube talks about being a writer, and I'm quite happy to just watch those, you know, forever. It's but I'm divorcing it from the actual writing process of having to see his films.
I'll agree with you on that. I like what Kevin Smith is and what he stands for, as like one of the first guys who got really famous doing like one camera super indie small budget like movies.
Respect you. Seems like a nice bloke, you know?
yeah it's just that what his actual films are,
yeah, exactly.
It's not something I'm super interested in.
No, but God bless him for cracking on. Yeah
no, like I like what he inspired, but not necessarily him. That's
mind you,
that's
have you view. Seen Red State?
Oh, yeah, I actually liked that a lot more than I thought I was going
it's
to.
Come out.
Honest.
I wasn't aware that had come out. Oh, and you were sort of bubbling under for a long time. Oh, okay.
Yeah,
I watched that on in an amazing double bill with Fargo up in London at the Prince Charles, and he came out and did like a Q&A afterwards. It was really cool. It was fun. Mm. Sorry, just bragging there. That's no story. just showing off, you know.
I would be all for a sequel to Dogma, just because I don't know what you would possibly do.
Well,
Jesus is back, I guess. Like
Jesus is back again.
I mean, those zombie hockey players are always a problem. You zombie kid hockey players. So I mean, they're an ongoing issue. They could come back. You know, God could be visiting, wandering around or something. You gets whacked over the head again. See, it's either that or it's a commentary on, rather than it being what's the name of the fast food joint?
Movies.
Yeah. So rather than movies this time, it's some reference to Apple, which could very well, in fact, be causing the end of the world, or Facebook, or similar.
I talking about fast food there, my mind completely went tangential. I started thinking about Good Burger. Mm. any Keenan and Kel fans out here? No.
Yes.
Yeah, there are.
Orange soda.
acceptable response.
I want to do some Keenan and Kel quotes, but it's not, you know. And also, I'd like to point out Good Burger is not Keenan and Kel universe. Technically, it's a separate thing, which then evolved into Keenan and Kel. This is important to me.
I'm too old for this. The hell of Keenan and Kel.
Okay, I think it's time after that to finally move on to the part of the show where we sort of grill James to an inch of his life on a metaphorical level.
Yeah.
Welcome to Main Feature, home of the Main Feature. Can I take your order, please?
Yeah. I'm going to sit and cheer on every Keenan and Kel reference from now on. That's my role on the show.
I missed it. Yes. I feel like there's a gap somewhere in my cultural knowledge.
You were probably
slightly too old.
You're probably finishing secondary school or like in college or something or having a job.
I think I was probably at university when.
Oh, uni.
Yeah, I think I might have just.
I need you to get a gap in your cultural knowledge, 5 cups of tea and a plank of wood and meet me in the graveyard at midnight.
Oh, here goes.
Yeah. We made it.
Okay, we have actually got a couple of proper questions for you. Because that's always helpful.
Yeah.
I think it's supposed to be.
I read that. Yeah, I just heard with the little face. Yeah. There we go.
Oh no, it's cool, guys. I didn't need my ears. That's.
I'm sorry, bro. I lost my ears in Vietnam.
some guy from Reddit, and I'm assuming guy actually at this point, sadly, because Reddit is somewhat genderless most of the time. She would like to know. Why do most UK shows seem to have one series, two at max?
Oh, like Doctor Who?
Yeah.
Yeah, or Coronation Street.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not...
I think he's probably...
Well, is he possibly thinking more of comedy?
He might be.
I suspect...
Space.
Thinking more of... Oh, God, space was okay. Well, I think it's actually very hard to get people back for a third series in a comedy show, weirdly enough. And that was the thing with... With Green Wing, we did 2 series and
Christmas
a Christmas special. Yeah, and there were so many kind of guys in it that it had kind of run out of steam anyway. But the idea trying to get all that cast back again for a third series was just, I think, going to be impossible.
Was typecasting a problem? Fear of typecasting.
For the actors?
Yeah.
Yeah, you mean? I don't know. I think, to be honest, they were all proper actors. They were like grown-ups who'd done RSC and stuff, and possibly they just didn't... I couldn't blame them for wanting to go and do something else, yeah. So I don't know. I think they're all quite broad characters, and I think there's only so long you can play characters that sort of big and broad before it just becomes empty. And I think it was right on the cusp, but I think everyone decided wisely to leave it where it is. But it is a bit of a British thing. I mean, it's like with Fawlty Towers, that had kind of two series, didn't it, in space. And I think there's a thing with British comedy where it's seen as a quite an honourable thing to bow out kind of while you haven't fucked it up, essentially. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, I think I've actually just thought of three non-comedy shows that have only had one or two series that are a bit geeky. Hex, Urban Gothic, I guess that's two horror shows, and actually no, it's three, because I was going to say Strange as well.
Okay.
Yeah, they've only had... Actually, I think each of those has managed to have two series.
I think things are getting more series. I mean, think of things like Peep Show, and I think
Peep Show doesn't seem to want to end.
It does. It just I think a lot of the problem is commissioners want something to be a great big hit, and if something's been going along for two series, you can guess it's not going to be a great big hit for the third series. So why not cut your losses? This is pressure coming from the other end. Why not cut your losses and try something new, which might be a huge hit? And it's probably the next thing isn't going to be a huge hit, but you can sort of keep on going. And creatively, it's more interesting to sort of knock things on the head, I think, to be honest, after two series. And we're just not psychologically set up in this country as writers to run something for that long. It's just...
Maybe people would feel less shortchanged if their series were rather than 6 to 13 episodes or a couple of episodes, it was more nearing the 20s.
Yeah, there's such a huge difference in the American way of doing. And when you try and compromise and do a series of 13 episodes or something, you start to get the worst of both worlds. So you start to sort of lose grip of something because you're getting other writers in. But without the American thing, where you've got a horde of incredibly, well-motivated, well-paid, incredibly bright writers to sort of really keep that momentum going. So you can, if you stretch it too far, you sort of fall down the gap. So there's a sort of cultural... Sorry, I felt like I sort of slightly sneered at your point then. But it's an interesting question.
I was going to say, could it be in part... I mean, I know nothing about this. I'll come out and say it straight out. But in part, if we're comparing it to the US, where they have, the writer's room format versus the, one or two writer format we have over here,
it's more of an auteur thing with one or two writers, just because it's so expensive to do it the American way. In fact, because in Green Wing, it was sort of team written, and in that there were six or seven of us, and we thought we were kind of writing it the American way, in that we went off in our surly corners and grumped and did a couple of pages, and then sort of together 3 months and try and sort of compile it all. And we actually met the really nice guy who's one of the producers of Friends at a sort of a later stage, and we said, "Oh, we've been writing the American way like this," and we told him, and he just stared at us. What the hell? What the hell have you been doing? That's not how we do it at all. And the American way. One person to break a story to come up with a sort of storyline and kind of come up with a half an hour's worth of narrative events and a loose sort of episode. Then you sit around the table with kind of 15 very highly paid Harvard graduates, and you punch it up and just working it until you've got a really crammed 22 minutes or whatever it is now, terrifyingly. It just isn't the money or the will to do that in this country. So that's the very different systems.
Okay. Also got the budgetary concerns as well, because you think we've got four channels essentially that are commissioning, well, five now, I suppose, that are commissioning TV shows and so on over here. You've got how many in the States, and how much more money have they got from the advertising revenue and everything?
Yeah, it's rabid over there. I mean, where the things have to do well or they can. I mean, one sketch show, this is a few years ago now, but one American comedy sketch show was canned in the first advert break. Because it's so
badly.
Obviously, they were sitting there watching, the Nielsen boxes, whatever they were, people were just turning off, and then they just kind of, which what I worry about is, well, what do they have lined up? Do they have half a show somewhere they could just stick on for that exact eventuality?
No, don't they normally fall back on Garfield in that kind of situation?
No, probably. There's probably hours of just Garfield just generates itself at this point. I think you put a.
There's a cat. He's going to eat some lasagna.
I would have thought, or it might be like Peanuts reruns, Snoopy show.
Oh, nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to sneak in one of my questions. from my personal experience, I've been wondering this and you've never said, just how much does your script writing experience now influence your game mastering at
my,
the table?
My tabletop role-playing game mastering. Yeah, I should explain that Emily and Paul have both I used to play D&D a lot on Tuesday nights and events that I can't do at the moment because I've got very young children and my brain is full. So I used to run quite a few different games around D&D and The One Ring, which is kind of a Lord of the Rings sort of thing. How do I, it's more the other way around, actually. I'm not sure. They fed into each other. So I was into sort of D&D and GMing before I wrote scripts. So when I started scripts, I was quite happy with the whole collaborative thing because I'm used to sort of collaborative storytelling medium. It can be like a ponce about it, which is quite handy in comedy because it is more collaborative. It didn't necessarily help me tell better stories and it didn't necessarily help me make better sort of scenarios when I was playing a game. But since I do a lot of work on structure because that's always been my weakest point. Oddly, that's really helped me structure individual sessions of gameplay with a sort of 3X structure and stuff. And it's a bit more innate now. So it's less trying to force some people to jump through the hoops of a story I've already made up, which it was the classic DMing sort of mistake I used to make. Of like, I've written a crap fantasy novel. Now you have to listen to me make you go through it. that's fun for everyone, isn't it? And then, you're really upset with people. If you introduce a cool, mysterious character in the first place, I stab him.
I want to go to the church. No, you don't.
Yeah. You don't stab him. Time has gone backwards. You don't, so it's just, now I've it's really helped me kind of loosen up. They sort of fed into each other, I think, hopefully to the advantage of both, I would like to think. But it is kind of interesting because I've moved more towards drama writing now and it's not that collaborative in this country anyway. And they're delighted if you say you're quite, you'd like to get some other writers in and work on something sort of collaborative. They look at you with like huge Disney eyes, the BBC people, because they're delighted to hear them. Because it's not, the other extreme is like your sort of Polanski way when you sort of, write it, direct it, produce it, sew all the costumes yourself, all the music on a harmonica in the background and stuff like that.
And so get everyone tea.
Yeah, I think he probably draws a line getting everyone tea, suspect. Yeah. But yeah, it's I find it really interesting. They sort of feed into each other in a strange sort of way.
Do you want to ask yours?
Yeah, so do you prefer writing alone or the group system that was used in kind of Green Wing or kind of that type of thing? Or
does it depend?
Or are both suited better to different formats?
Yeah.
To end the question. The boring answer is they are both suited to different formats. I like doing a bit of everything. So team writing is fantastic because you're really challenged by the other writers. At the end of the day, you look through the other person's work. And if you've done something really funny, you think, oh, you fucker, I really want to top that. And that's really, really healthy and that's good fun. And you get a sort of adrenaline there that there isn't with any other kind of writing, in my experience. But sometimes you just want to go off and do your own thing and create something that's entirely, like a 50-minute script that's entirely yours. So I've kind of done both extremes. And I've co-written a sitcom with my wife, oddly enough. We worked on a thing together. And that was really, really interesting. But it is very much horses for courses. But I mean, yeah, I'm really lucky to sort of try all these different kind of formats. But I think the pure adrenaline, I really miss the sitting around a table with the Green Wing people and just being foul to each other, frankly. It's really good fun. And then working with the actors and workshopping and stuff, because that just, you just felt like you were actually doing something interesting rather than just staring out of a window and sighing, which is what my script writing consists of, sadly.
Peter, do you want to ask your question?
Yeah, I mean, a massive issue with regards to any aspiring writer, myself included to some degree, is the issue of representation, finding an agent. Do you have any tips or insights into the process of getting an agent or, how you made those steps towards, professional writing within film, TV, literature and how an agent interacts with that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm telling you things you don't already know. It's a nightmare, and it's a classic catch-22 because it's very hard to get an agent until you've done some work. And of course, it's incredibly hard to get the work until you've got an agent. So that makes things really, really difficult. So I had agents how I got into writing, essentially, is I started, I won a sitcom writing, a comedy writing competition for Channel 4 in about 1999. And that kind of got me some interest from agents, but none of them really committed until I got this Green Wing thing. And by then I'd be writing for Bob the Builder and Smack the Pony. Then I got the Green Wing thing, which was the real quit the day job. you know, right, I'm actually going to do this full time as a living now. At which point, suddenly, all the agents were interested because they had to do fuck all. They just had to, like, check the contracts. So it's money for nothing. Fantastic. So, so at that point, I wouldn't say I could pick an agent at all, but suddenly I felt like I had a bit more weight in my corner, which in one regard isn't helpful, but it kind of means you do have to plow on and get there yourself. In order to get an agent, you will be rejected. But to be honest, a lot of agents will reject you, not because they might reject because they think you're crap, but they might think you're brilliant. But they have enough comedy writers or drama writers, or you know, so my agent has a little sort of stable. He's got I don't know how many kind of soap writers, but he's got a few of those. He's got a couple of comedy writers, and he's got a few drama writers, and he doesn't really need many more of each of those because he's got enough. He doesn't because if Atlantis comes up. And they say they're looking for writers. If he's got three or four people who would fit that job, then that's fine. If he's got eight or nine, then they're all, you know, all his clients can be fighting each other. It's a bit difficult. So you might be turned down just on grounds of practicality. You just have to sort of keep on plugging away and have your own stuff that you can point to, which is easier said than done. But it is. Anyone trying to get an agent has my sympathies because all the power is you know, outside your hands. Xbox. Yeah, I think I just nudged something and put the Xbox on. I'm sorry.
I don't know how because our Xbox is just randomly turned on.
The haunted Xbox.
Death box.
Okay. Out of interest on the agents front, is it still definitely a good idea before you approach an agent to actually to basically check whether or not they are taking anyone on?
Yeah,
and be polite and kind of check are they okay with you actually sending stuff?
Yeah, are they accepting unsolicited scripts? Don't send your thing to every single person in that agency because then they're all wasting time reading the same thing. So just an introductory email letter saying, look, I've written this thing. Who's the best person in your agency to send it to if you take unsolicited scripts? Or you can bypass an agent for a few years and you know, go to the BBC writers room if you're writing scripts. They'll take, you know, there's only like four of them, bless them, read like a million scripts. But things happen through there. Things do happen. So you kind of have to plow in on your own and eventually I hope you get picked up, at which point an agent will come to you, which is, you know, nice when it happens. It takes a long time.
Okay. I'm going to ask, Retroid did have a question for you and he would like to know, what's it like writing for sketch shows like One of More Time Praise, Smack the Pony? Also, is that series now available in Findus Beef Products?
Topical humour. So, hats off. What's it like? Hello, Retroid. What's it like writing for sketch shows? It's funny. I don't know. It's kind of... I've been writing for sketch shows on and off for years, and I'm sort of drifting away from it now because it's... they are fun to write because you just sit there and you don't have to go anywhere. You just write things to amuse yourself. The problem I find is the things that amuse me in sketches don't amuse anyone else in the world. So, you know, fun for me, it's not making me any money. So it depends how involved you are in the process. If you're sending in, I mean, basically, if you see a sketch that you like and you want to write for it, find the name of the producer, not the executive producer because they do it, they just wear suits. So find the name of the actual producer. Send them eight or nine sketches that would fit that show, and then if there's a couple of good ones, you're in with a good chance. But if you're involved with a show and you're there for like rehearsals and stuff like that, and if you're near London, it's kind of doable. Then probably invite you in. Then it's really good fun and it's really satisfying, and you make that sort of emotional connection with it. But otherwise, it can be a bit of an abstract sort of process, to be honest. But it's good for the CV to get some good, you know, sounding cynical. It's good for the CV to get some sketch shows on your CV. I think I'm trying to think what else I written for. I wrote for Smack the Pony. I did get a few things in Man Straight Woman, which I've seen about half of them. It's really hard to see for some reason. I think Armstrong and Miller, I got a commission to write some stuff and I never really made it through. So it's quite, you know, you get a lot of it. Like any other part of the process, you get a lot of sort of constant rejection. So, you know, if you're a geek, you're used to that, so it's fine.
Okay. I wanted to ask, because we were talking about it last week and we've got Martin here and we've got you here, an invited script writer. What are your feelings on the Women in Fridge trope.
The woman in fridge trope. Oh, yeah.
This as opposed to Indiana Jones.
Yeah. No, comic book thing. It's isn't it? Thingy's bird was stuffed in a fridge. Who is it? The Flash. No.
It's a reference to the general trope of a. Martin, do you want to outline this one?
Sure. It's when a female character, either a well-developed one from, like, previously in the comic, or one who is just there for that one shot or whatever, or, you know, not even comics necessarily, exists primarily in order to be killed off by the villain in some incredibly gruesome way in order to provide motivation for the male characters of the comic slash film slash whatever. So, yeah.
Oh, like, what was the Infinity? What was the Ralph Dibny's wife who's killed in Infinity? That sort of. It's difficult, isn't it? Because I am really. I watch a lot of crime shows, and I started watching Ripper Street. Has anyone seen that recently?
I wanted to watch it.
And it looked great. It's just, I've seen too many mutilated female corpses, do you know? And I never thought I'd say that. I thought I'd get sick of seeing women being hacked up. But suddenly I thought, do you know, I just don't want to see that anymore. Enough of it in real life. I don't want it on my telly as well. No, I mean, I'm pretty sick of it. At the same time, bad things happen to women in real life, and it's you've just got to be very, very careful. If bad things really happen to women, to motivate your male characters, excuse me, so they can fall to their knees and go, no, then you need to think about what you're doing.
Yeah, the big heart of it is not that you can't, you know, use tragic events, you know, it's not that you can't use things like rape and murder in your stories, it's that you shouldn't use them just in order to provide motivation for the male characters, you know. It's that's the heart of why the trope is bad, and, you know, why it gets flagged up.
Yeah, so. It's too easy in superhero comics, I think, to do that thing.
Yeah.
Shocking. So God, I just read I fairly recently read the Jeff Loeb Ultimates 3, let's take it, and it's just insane. Just someone just being shocking, kind of for the sake of it, and kind of missing the point of the whole comic. Anyway, I go in, but then I read too many of those in a row, and I really went off comics for a bit, frankly. So yeah, so it's not a great. It's not.
Yeah.
It's just that. Would we consider I've forgotten the name of the character, the love interest to Connor McLeod in Highlander an example of this, or is that more tastefully done?
She dies of old age, doesn't she? I think
she does.
So I think that's acceptable. That's a part of his story, but it's not like she's horribly murdered by the Kurgan to, you know, and her entrails are scattered about the place, so he can go, no, it's just it touched you. Yeah, I think that's kind of a, it is, I suppose, a female character dying to motivate a male character, but that's just about kind of acceptable. But yeah, these days, if that was being done. In fact, Highlander is being rebooted, isn't it? So I'm fairly sure.
Is it?
Yeah, I think.
Whoa, when did I miss that?
The battle went up.
About a year ago.
Oh, bloody hell. Can't leave bloody anything alone, can they?
Directed by J.J. Abrams, don't worry.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
and written by Orson Scott Card.
No!
Her
name was Heather, wasn't it?
Being Luna,
it was Heather. Quite right.
And I think that was more to... highlight the fact that he was watching everybody he loved die around him slowly.
Well, it's the horrible things the Kurgan did, but he just left her behind is the thing, and the Kurgan constantly mentions that after that point
to wind him up. Yeah,
yeah,
because he didn't actually find out until Heather died, did he? Because she kept it a secret from him.
That's right.
Oh, that's right. Yes, I remember. Have you ever read a novelization of the Highlander book? It's surprisingly good.
Yeah.
There's a bit about the Kurgan who meets the he has a prostitute, and she says, "Hi, I'm Candy," and he said, "Yes, you are." Great being,
of course you are.
Embarrassed about these terrible scars that she's got or something, and then he shows her all his scars. It's a moment of interesting kind of tenderness. You think if that had been in the film, that's a great little moment. It really rounds him out as a character. Probably why they cut it out. I don't know, or maybe a bit.
Didn't they have a bit like that in the Sorcerer, Highlander 3, the Sorcerer, where the sorcerer gets out of the ice and stuff, and he goes and finds a hooker.
I am not the authority on that. Mario
Van
Peebles,
is it?
Yes, yeah, Mario Van Peebles.
I can't remember the film well enough to really say.
I've got a file somewhere of all prostitutes that appeared in certain fancy films, so I'll go through that.
Okay.
Binders and binders full of prostitutes. Getting some American politics in there. There we are.
I think I've got some random quick questions for you. well, one of them might not be so quick. Favorite role-playing game ever?
Oh, my, well, famous one, favorite one I've ever run was, in fact, The One Ring. I really enjoyed that, which is so this is based on it's Tolkien nerd intensive, but it's sort of based in set in this sort of gap between the end of The Hobbit and beginning of Lord of the Rings, and it's all set around Mirkwood. And somehow it's just this fantastic kind of atmospheric role-playing game with almost no magic in it. It's just sort of stories. You could be just sort of Saxons trudging through a forest in this game, couldn't you, fighting the occasional kind of big monster. But there's just something incredibly atmospheric.
Or you could be a hobbit wandering through a forest that finds plants that have sap that is actually flammable.
It's flammable sap. Yeah, the flammable sap session. That was a good one. That's what things pick up. I really enjoyed that. That was good. And we played the big formative sort of experience for those role playing was Stormbringer, which was which is based on Michael Moorcock novels. And we played this for about 3 years or something in sixth form, or going up to sixth form. And I'd never read the books, so we were playing in it. I was really aware we were playing in this universe that I'd never actually read the books, but the DM was massively into the books and was also a genius as well. And it's just it's incredible. So twice a week, we'd play 2 or 3 hours of this Stormbringer game and encounter all the Eternal Champions and all that sort of thing. And there's just something kind of really mind-blowing about that as a medium. No, it was great.
Okay. I'd like to know, and that's if you can answer it, what's happening with that short zombie comic you've been working on?
Dead Roots, yeah. This is a thing which James Moran, who wrote Severance and Doctor Who and some Torchwood, and his mate Mike Garley, who's a sort of freelance comic editor, have come up with this online comics anthology called Dead Roots, which there's 4 issues coming out quarterly. I think the first one came out... Halloween, appropriately, and I've got a story in it. It's sort of an anthology all set in the first, if you like it, it's like the first 20 minutes of a zombie movie when things are starting to go weird. I think mine's coming out in the second issue, possibly.
Okay.
So it's at the moment it's online only, but it's going to be printed up, I think, when it's finished. I mean, initially, it was just kind of a light sort of thing that, to be quite honest, didn't think it was going anywhere. It was going to be good fun. But it's been picked up by Future Publishing, who make publish SFX and Total Film and the like. So it's great. It's got a little bit of weight behind it now. And they're doing a separate thing called VS Comics, which I've got a story coming in that soon in April as well. So it's kind of fun just sort of piling into comics, which is a whole new thing for me.
Okay, and I think the final random question we had... any quick thoughts on the Star Wars situation from sequels to rumours of one-off prequel films?
I'm proud to say I no longer care about Star Wars. Although, that said, some sort of crime series set on Tatooine that never leaves Tatooine. That you know, there's Jawas there, the Sand Tusken Raider things. They've never really gone into that. I'd be really happy with a sort of slightly sandy crime series set in Tatooine. That's about the extent of my caring about Star Wars.
That's a bit like me. I'd love them to make a TV series or a film of Gotham Central.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah. No problem with that at all. Yeah. But no, it's just, I don't know. It's just this huge corporate. I think when Yoda started doing phones, that's when just something inside me died.
They really sold out Yoda on that, didn't they?
So and they didn't even have the Yoda phone joke.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Pay extra money to have Yoda for your company, Vodafone, then... Or have a Vodafone joke. I don't understand why you buy the rights and then not do. Maybe they drew the line there, isn't it?
So someone woke up the morning it was filmed and just went, Yodafone, damn it! God damn it!
Does anyone else think that CSI Tatooine would be the shit? You can just imagine it. There you are. You've got your detective. He walks up to a crime scene and you've got a sand purse on the ground. Oh, detective, I'm glad you're here. We found this guy. He's already dead. He's been dead for a few hours. He's got a massive bantha tooth stuck out of his chest. Oh, looks like he's got a Tusken Raider.
Oh, no.
That's the best I could do. I'm sorry.
I'm developing a steampunk CSI thing with the BBC at the moment, which is very exciting. So that's a fun thing. So trying to do a Victorian... Well, Ripper Street is kind of a Victorian CSI, but mine's more sort of properly steampunk, so it's got weird shit going on in it. So it's quite fun doing a police procedural, but in a genre sort of way. So that's a fun place to explore, I think.
What's your policy on cogs?
To do something. You can't just do cogs on shit and call it... Fine. Yes. Actually, they have to link up and do that thing where one goes around and makes the other one go around as well, because that's how cogs work. But just cogs on a hat, no. I won't.
Did you ever hear the steampunk episode of Nerds?
Mm. I did not.
I might have laid into it a little bit.
Did you? Oh, well, it is. It's in many ways sort of moribund as a genre, but I think there's some really interesting things you can do with it. If you're not doing it, hey, look, we're mental. We've got top hats and goggles. What do you make of minds? Now an airship, you know. We bring more to the table than that, really. So,
Bugs, I mean, steampunk is obviously all about kind of, you know, the steam kind of stuff in Victorian era. What other kind of genres could you make just by mashing stuff up like that? What would be your ideal kind of punk, as it were?
The ideal punk.
Adjective punk.
Yeah.
What's my ultimate adjective? I quite like the idea of cave punk. I don't know. I really like Georgian stuff. So Regency punk. Because it's just something. The Georgians are fantastic. They're just that little bit less stuffed shirt than the Victorians.
Hmm.
But they're kind of, you know, smelly and disgusting, but full of life. So, and they've got great big cuffs. So, but on the other hand, you know, Jack Sparrow. It's difficult, isn't it?
Yeah. I'd kind of want to go like Technosaurus.
Oh.
On the one hand, mildly futuristic sci-fi. On the other hand, dinosaurs combined to form Dino Riders. Or not Dino Riders, whichever way you want to go with it. But either way, dinosaurs and technology is sweet.
They actually did that in the 90s with a TV cartoon show, didn't they, Dino?
Yeah, it was Dino Riders. I've always said
it. I'm old, leave me alone.
Personally, I like the idea of going for punk, where you just get some punks and you glue more punks to them until it's just infinite Russian doll punks.
However close you go, they're punks.
I was going to say on the dinosaur front, Dinotopia is like more advanced than the Flintstones, because there's kind of sort of turn of the century Victorian tech going on.
I guess that'd be kind of dino punk then.
Yeah, that's steampunk. Was it like dinosaurs fit into the whole steampunk thing because of, you know, the Challenger novels and stuff? Yeah. So you can, you know, there's always room for more dinosaurs. Well, yeah, huge.
Dinosaur in a cummerbund.
Lord, sorry.
Velociraptors riding in airships.
Just unacknowledged dinosaurs in the middle of a cyberpunk, in the middle of a steampunk setting. Just no one draws attention to it.
Would the dinosaurs be feeling the threat of their own existence because of the fact that people managed to create sentient steam powered dinosaurs?
Yeah. Yeah, there's just one dinosaur which has his like tiny little arms taken off and replaced with gigantic robot arms just wandering around going, I never asked for this. It's the best.
T-Rex can scratch where he could never scratch before, but not sure if want.
Does T-Rex dare to scratch? It's scratch too close to the sun, my T-Rex Icarus.
I'm not sure what's happened.
We've gone down a dark road here.
Bro, we're going to have some weird cul-de-sac now.
I'm going to try and stop giggling here, and then maybe I can say that that's all we've got time for this. Amazingly. It's been absolutely fantastic having James, Martin, and having Peter back for this episode.
Again.
Otherwise known as Paul and Paul. We have Retroid. We're looking forward to having you back next week. So, it's good night from...
It's good night from Go James Henry. Oh, wait, I was just reading off the script. Oh, so just go.
It's an instruction.
Go Gadget James Henry.
Where can we find you on the internet?
I'm on Twitter, James. Oh, just put James Henry in Twitter or something, you'll find it. I'm not.
You can find me on the Google. I've been Martin Fulder. You can find me on Twitter on Bionic Sheep, or check out my website, Erno Video Games. We talk about stuff.
And you can find me, Peter Cooper, on Twitter, Peter B. Cooper. You can also now find me on my absolutely awful and paltry Facebook page. facebook.com/PeterCooperAuthor. That is
for friends.
And it's good night from me, Paul, aka onearmed_cookie on Twitter, and you can also find me lurking around thegamejar.com.
Yeah, it's good night from me, Paul Blair. I have a website, paul-blair.com, and I'm on Twitter as Paul Blair.
And it's good night from me, Emily King. You can find me on Twitter at ek6891. You can also wander by my website if you want, ek-creations.com. You can find Nerds Assemble on www.nerdsassemble.co.uk. We're also on iTunes. You can find us on Twitter at Nerds Podcast, plus we're on Facebook and Google Plus as Nerds Assemble Podcast. That is everything. Good night.
Good night.
Peace.
Bye.
Okay, we are now recording, if people can deal with this fact at all.
Get to the chopper!
But I can't. My leg is broken.
Oh.
It's actually...
If you breathe, we can kill it. Now it's all up to me.
Okay. Okay. Have you got that off your system yet?
No.
Okay, well, I'm sure there might
proceed.
I'm sure there'll be a moment where it'll be appropriate for you to say that. Yeah.
You mean there's a time when it's not appropriate to say on the Schwarzenegger quotes? Because I've yet to eat
right.
That.
That's my system. No, I can't. Everything sounds like a Schwarzenegger quote.
Oh.